Not long ago, the Congresses were liberal democratic.
They all hugged trees.
Banned DDTs.
Refused to be pragmatic.
Then voters said, our state is red, our message is emphatic.
We want some moral values and a Congress theocratic.
We're super zealous radicals against all things atrocious.
We like Fox News.
They share our views.
Ann Coulter is precocious.
If you cross me, you'll quickly see that we can be ferocious. We're super zealous radicals against all things atrocious. I'm little, 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 I'm little, I'm little,
hold on here. Hey, wait. You know, you don't have a corner on moral values, all right? Our state is blue. We don't like you. We won't give folks a fair chance.
We'll brag to you of our IQ while yours is like a pear plant.
We've got degrees like PhDs. We don't like your unfair rants.
You started wars, and what's more, you don't like SpongeBob SquarePants.
We're the super jealous far out left who'd like to run the nation.
You clear the way.
You wish no way.
It's classic confrontation.
Yet you all see the irony is most folks in the nation
are super cautious people who could use some moderation.
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. This program can be heard at 96.5 FM in the Sacramento area. And if you're just joining us, we're listening to Atnot Atmati talk about The Banker's New Clothes, where she takes a critical look at the banking industry.
So I think a lot of things are wrong with banking, and there is a lot we can do about it, but there's a lot of nonsense that prevents it.
Historically, in your view, has banking ever been right-sized or rightly positioned in our economy?
This inefficiency in banking, I think, is basically fundamental. I don't think, you know, sometimes people say, oh, banking was always fragile, you know, so it's nothing new, it's not derivative, it's not this, it's not that. It's true that banking has always been too fragile, and you can understand that, and we try to give a flavor for why that is, but it does not follow that because it was always fragile, that it was ever really efficient as an industry, or as, because really what happens if you want me to start with the teaching, start with deposits, which we all know. So deposits are like a road system, like infrastructure, okay? So we want a payment system, and we want to not carry around cash or gold or something like that. So that's how it started, really, giving the money to the banker in the trade shows in Europe. And the banker, you know, there's not a suitcase that you leave for safekeeping, you know. You just want your money back at some point. And so we depositors lend the bank money. And so from that point on, bankers had this money. And they thought, well, you know, there are also people needing loans, so let's also make loans. Let's invest that money. Let's go play a little bit. Of course, there was a little spread they could take. And the question is, when they make loans or when whatever it is they do with the money, invest in derivatives or other things, some risk is taken, all kinds of risk, which we go over. What can go wrong? What can go wrong? And, well, things can go wrong, and the question is, what happens then? Whose problem is it then? And so the word bankruptcy actually has the word bank in it, and bancarrota means broken bench. So when the depositor came and the money wasn't there, all they could do was break the bench of the banker. And that shows you kind of the control problem between the borrower and the lender, because the borrower takes the upside when it comes, doesn't share it with the lender, who's the depositor, us, or the other creditors. And on the downside, oops, it's everybody's problem. They both suffer, but so does the creditor in particular. Now scale that problem up, now move forward. Lots and lots of things happen. Sometimes banks are told by politicians to invest only in a particular area. There's always some agenda or other, because banks are where the money is, as the robber said. And so they might sometimes be fragile because they're not diversified. Sometimes they're fragile for other reasons. But if you look at the history of banking, first of all, they weren't even ever, for a long, long time, more than 150 years, they weren't even kind of limited liability corporations, the kind of corporations where shareholders, you know, can only lose what they invested and, you know, too bad for anybody who lent money or the collateral damage that happens. But they were private partnerships with the owners being liable for everything, and they had 50% of their funding from their own owner's money and only 50% from deposits. This is the middle of 19th century. They weren't corporations. And then as the 19th century developed and more corporations took place, banks were actually not very last kind of in that, because everybody understood that if banks had limited liability, if they could walk away, then deposits wouldn't be as safe and they wouldn't serve as well. But still, in the banking crisis in Glasgow, as we describe it, the shareholders were broke, not the depositors, because the shareholders had to cover. And even in the U.S., going into the 20th century, there was, depending on the state, double, triple, or unlimited liability for bank owners, even shareholders. And so you could actually lose as much as you invested, or double that, or even just be liable for you with your own assets if the bank lost money, couldn't pay the notes. This is before, you know, even central bank, and then there was a central bank. In any case, then we had the Depression, and then there were a lot of big, huge problems in banking. Bank holiday, banks didn't open, lots of runs on the banks. Part of the mystery of banks, all the movies, you know, It's This Wonderful Life, Mary Poppins, you know, rumor starts, the bank, everybody's standing in line, all that, like in Cyprus recently. And so the banks, then we established deposit insurance. And so the depositors kind of felt secure. And over the years, going back to the topic of development of the banking, they stopped putting sort of their own money or owner's money in. But our view, to your original question, is that the banker never wanted to put enough of their own money. And the way we tell the story, certainly with the guarantees, is that, you know, somebody else can share in the downside, so you want to leave a little bit more on the edge. In other words, the borrower becomes a little bit biased towards risk-taking and therefore towards more borrowing and averse to safe things, because once the debt is in place, the creditor bears the downside disproportionately from the upside, and the upside gets magnified and belongs to the borrower.
So, all that said, have we put in reform since the 08 crisis, and what would you like to see primarily as a reform?
Well, our analysis here is that this system is just fundamentally very fragile. One manifestation of a problem that everybody understands and everybody talks about in this country is too big to fail. But we explain how this comes about. It comes about because certain institutions would have a lot of systemic, in other words, they will drop a lot of dominoes and spill over to the rest of the economy if they fail. We saw Lehman failure. It was a relatively small banks by comparison to the banks we have today. To answer your question, no. We have there was this effort that the banks would tell you resulted in tripling of capital requirements. My favorite line on the tripling of capital requirements, they always like to say how much bigger it is than last time in fraction, is that the previous requirements were so ridiculously low that, as Martin Wolf said, tripling almost nothing doesn't give you a very large number. And so it was, you know, 2% of something called risk-weighted assets, which is not even all the assets. They ignore a bunch of them. And now it's sort of between 4.5 and 7. And these numbers just don't begin to have the right number of digits. And the backstop that's new is 3%. 3% of total assets. You do not find any healthy corporation in any industry that lives like that. And there's absolutely no reason the banks need to live like that. For example, if they did what Warren Buffett does, they could retain their earnings and immediately start building up their equity.
What do you mean?
Well, what I mean is, if you take a second mortgage on your house, you deplete your equity on the house. If you keep investing and your house value goes up and you do not take any money out as a corporation, if you retain all your earnings, then you build up your equity. This is how Apple lives, for example. They don't borrow at all. Now, the banks must borrow because they borrow from depositors, and it's part of what they do is to borrow. But that does not say that they can't actually back up their liabilities without needing deposit insurance or support, that they can't be more normalized like other corporations. They can't even have a minimum that they would demand from their borrowers of 20% to 30% equity. Instead, the requirements allow 3, 4, these kinds of numbers. So they are so fragile that just a small loss would start getting people nervous or getting them to be less able to lend as well as pay their debt. They get into a situation where we see credit crunches, and that's when we have to start investing in them and saving them and all of that. But there's no reason for that. The reason they don't lend is when they actually lost from previous investments. Well, why don't we make them better prepared so that when they lose next time, it's not somebody else's problem, but the people who got the upside.
Hi, I'm Steve Lerman. I'm the guy that produces, edits, narrates, and promotes Great Speeches and Interviews. I'm the guy responsible for airing in-depth interviews, speeches, and even debates on controversial subjects such as war and peace, and climate change and the economy. I hope you like listening to it as much as I like producing it. Access Sacramento broadcasts it on the internet every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m. And you can find the podcast at greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com as well as at Facebook.
I don't have to tell you things are bad. Everybody knows things are bad. It's a depression. Everybody's out of work or scared of losing their job. The dollar buys a nickel's worth. Banks are going bust. Shopkeepers keep a gun under the counter. Punks are running wild in the street. There's nobody anywhere who seems to know what to do, and there's no end to it. We know the air is unfit to breathe and our food is unfit to eat. We sit watching our TVs while some local newscaster tells us that today we had 15 homicides and 63 violent crimes, as if that's the way it's supposed to be. We know things are bad, worse than bad. They're crazy. It's like everything everywhere is going crazy, so we don't go out anymore. We sit in the house, and slowly the world we're living in is getting smaller, and all we say is, please, at least leave us alone in our living rooms. Let me have my toaster and my TV and my steel-belted radios, and I won't say anything. Just leave us alone. Well, I'm not going to leave you alone. I want you to get mad. I don't want you to protest. I don't want you to ride. I don't want you to write to your congressmen because I wouldn't know what to tell you to write. I don't know what to do about the depression and the inflation and the Russians and the crime in the street. All I know is that first, you've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value. So, I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore! I want you to get up right now. Get up, go to your windows, open them, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore. Things have got to change. Then we'll figure out what to do about the depression and the inflation and the oil crisis. But first, get up out of your chairs, open the window, stick your head out and yell, and say, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore. Stick your head out of the window, open it, and stick your head out and keep yelling and yell, I'm as mad as hell, I'm not going to take this anymore. Just get up from your chairs right now. Climb.
I'm mad as hell, how am I going to take this anymore?
I'm mad as hell! I'm not gonna take it anymore!
I'm mad as hell and I'm not gonna take it anymore!
I'm not gonna take it anymore!
And now back to Atnat Atmadi talking about the banker's new clothes.
But aren't banks fundamentally different than other corporations?
Here you go. Well, they would like you to think that. They're not that different, actually. They respond to the incentives that they're given, and they behave in precisely understandable way given what we allow them to do. The problem is that on this issue of risk and on the issue of indebtedness, they are corporations, actually, who are different from other people in that we need them to be safe, and therefore we end up providing them safety nets that make them more risky, because it gives them incentives to take more risk and to borrow more so that they can get more of the upside and leave the downside to others. Our job, or the regulator's job, the politician's job, is to counter that addiction instead of feeding it. And unfortunately, this has been missed. And so we're putting ourselves in the box of needing, you know, if you think that the financial crises are like some disaster that happens, you know, solving it by putting ambulances, by having, you know, resolution and living wills and all of that. Well, an ounce of prevention is worse than a pound of cure is sort of our epigraph to the chapter, What to Do. You can go in and tell them what to do, all of that. But the first and foremost, no matter what else you do, you have to straighten out their funding mix, which is just completely and utterly unhealthy and unnecessarily unhealthy. In other words, fixing that is just allowing them to do everything more consistently. And the reason that we're not doing it is because they somehow confuse every decision maker to thinking that what we got used to is somehow the way it should be. It's just wrong.
Anat Admati also serves on the FDIC's Systemic Resolution Advisory Committee, which is what?
Well, this is part of the Dodd-Frank Act. This is called the Title II of Dodd-Frank, and what it does is it creates an alternative to bankruptcy for more corporations. So right now, for more institutions that are called systemic. So right now, or all along, since the creation of the FDIC, FDIC knows how to take over failed small banks. The biggest it did was maybe Washington Mutual, maybe $50 billion or whatever. Now the FDIC is in charge of, in theory, taking down Bank of America if need be. We are asked to trust that in a crisis or not in a crisis, the FDIC, which now has authority to do this and is probably the best around to be having this authority, will actually resolve, basically, you know, create some kind of a process by which shareholders will be wiped out, creditors will somehow be paid, essential functions will be maintained somehow. And like they do for the small banks, you know, where depositors are paid and they kind of sell off the pieces, that they will create a better mechanism than, say, the Lehman bankruptcy, which has dragged on for 4 years and wasted almost everything that was even there. And so whoever is deemed systemic, and we're not there yet, but it can be any time, the FDIC is charged with resolving them. So I'm on a committee that is meant to advise on this process. In this committee are esteemed people like Paul Volcker, John Reed, ex-CEO of Citi, a number of other people. And so we meet not that frequently, but we have full-day meetings in which we're presented with progress on this issue. And it's very good to be there because I get to ask a bunch of questions and work with basically what I consider right now the best regulator in D.C. right now, and then one most concerned with the public, which is the FDIC. And so we asked the question, could we eliminate the problems just by being able to allow these companies to go into bankruptcy, which is the normal thing, or something like bankruptcy, which is a normal thing that a failed company does. If you take on too much debt, usually, and you can't pay your debts, you go into bankruptcy. Can we create something equivalent for banks that won't have collateral damage? That's the issue. Well, it's very problematic. They have some things in what's called Title I that are supposed to help, like living wills, you know, tell me how I would resolve you under bankruptcy. But then I won't resolve it under bankruptcy. So there are all kinds of issues there. And supposedly in Title I, there would be great supervision and there'll be good preparation. This is, let me just say, the FDIC is doing a great job trying to do this, but it is not a point you want to get to. Just the trigger by itself is already too late. When you get to that point, when you're going to trigger this, as Paul Volcker said in our first meeting, when we represented what FDIC would have done if it had authority to resolve Lehman Brothers instead of sending Lehman Brothers to bankruptcy, and it would have done great, Paul Volcker's question was, and what would you do day 2, 3, and 4 after you did this in the first day? Because, of course, they had months to sort of redo this. And, of course, in a crisis, they'll all fail at the same time. And the policymakers will be tempted to, whatever law they made yesterday, change it because it's a crisis time. We don't want to get there. So the question is, are we stuck? Is this an earthquake or not? And the strong message of our book is this is not an earthquake. This is not a natural disaster. This is something that you can do a huge amount to avoid and prevent. And while you do that, also get a better, safer system, less distorted system, less bloated with subsidies system. Just about everything you can think about is good. And there's absolutely hardly anything you can think about that's bad unless you're a banker.
And we have been talking with Anat Admati, who is a professor of finance and economics at the Graduate School of Business here at Stanford University and the co-author of this new book, The Banker's New Clothes, What's Wrong with Banking and What to Do About It.
Real reason that you wanna fight, I'm not buying, no, I can't see the light. It makes no difference how you're waving the flag. It's all just a power dance. No, no, enough to do here, why can't they see? It's time better spent, it's no mystery. No, no one.
We seem to be having with you, the American people, and that people don't seem to think that I identify with a common man, but I'm here to reassure all Americans that I'm just an average guy like everybody else. I put my pants on the same as you every day.
That's right. The butler holds them, and Mick puts one leg at a time into said trousers, just like everybody else.
You're not helping, honey. Now, look.
Okay.
We're going to have to find a way with identifying with that other 99%, because I think, you know, unfortunately, we're going to need some of their votes, you know what I mean? So, look, let's try this again from the top, all right? Here we go.
Right.
Now, what does the middle class do? Who make just a million or two?
The man who might be facing so much debt that he screams.
The fans of NASCAR racing whose friends don't own teams.
They must have some bag of tricks if their private jet just seats six. However do they manage to fully staff their yacht? Oh, what do simple folk do? We do not.
I have often talked while I'm out and about with folks who all get by with clever ways. See, when their budget's tight, they simply do without, then ask their trust fund for a modest raise. And that's what simple folk do every day.
Go without?
So they say.
What else do the simple folk do with one Cadillac and not two? The poor guy who's not seeing his portfolio grow.
Instead of going skiing at Vail, they're at Stowe. Yuck!
What if their fortune is small?
They'll drink Dom instead of Cristal.
Why, if I needed money, I'd sell a few Van Goghs, 'cause that's
average Joes. Now this is a great land where simple folk can soon dream a little dream, I've heard them say.
Even you, the billionaire, son of a mere tycoon, can hope to be the president someday. And that's what simple folk do, I should say.
Are you calling me simple?
I should say.
All right, now look. What should the middle class do?
They should cast their votes all for you.
Then we'd be in the White House.
A quite small house for you.
Yes, but see, that's downsizing.
And
that's what simple folks do.
And now, messages from Access Sacramento.